The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy,
but we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to our Friday program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in. I want to run through a couple of announcements. Number one is today's show is going to be on the 60-minute format without a break, and we will have a hard ending at the top of the hour. So if you want to get an email in or a phone call in to talk to our guest, Gary Hudson, you need to do that well in advance of the show ending at the 60-minute point. We will not be going into the last part of a typical Space Show program. So plan your emails and your calls accordingly. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient, and we'll answer the phone and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Also, thespaceshow.com is our website, so do visit that. And there are a couple of menus there, but the one I'm going to call your attention to is on the far right side, upcoming shows. So that is also our blog for each show. So when you see a program appear there, you can start commenting or asking questions. If you do so before a program or during a program, I will get your comments and be able to present them to our guests during the live show. If you post afterwards, it's just a traditional blog, post the live program. So do check it out. And the other thing I want to call your attention to is that we are a 501c3 nonprofit with the Space Show and OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. So we can bring you these programs because many of you do financially contribute to and support the Space Show. And we thank you very much for that support. And if you are a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. In California, we're a California Public Benefit Corporation. So do support us if you like our programming and would like to see the Space Show continue. Remember, we are trademarked and copyrighted. You are free to download our programs and to share them on the Internet or give people the URLs to them. There's just a few rules. Don't do anything commercial with our programs, and don't edit them and then put those edits up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. Podcasting is through gigadial.net. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. If you have any podcasting issues, including issues with your smartphone, please do contact us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have sponsors for today. Check them out on the banner ads going across our website. However, since we're on the 60-minute format instead of the 90-minute format, I just want to thank Integrated Space Analytics for their Integrated Space Plan. They're a great sponsor. So is Orbital ATK, the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics, and then also Celestis, which, of course, is the premier space memorial burial service around the world. So we very much thank our sponsors, and that brings me to our program today. So Gary Hudson is our returning guest, and many of you who listen to a lot of space shows know Gary. You should probably know him anyway. But Gary has, close to, I guess, maybe 50 years of experience in rocket design and rocketry and related topics. He is the president of the Space Studies Institute, and today we're going to talk to him about the Space Studies Institute, and they have an initiative known as the Exotic Propulsion Initiative. And as you know, the space show is very interested in exotic propulsion. So who better than to talk about it with is Gary Hudson. So, Gary, welcome back to our program. How are you today?
I'm fine, David, and thanks for the introduction. I'm delighted to be here. As usual, I realize this is, I believe, appearance number 8.
I actually thought it was more, but I didn't count. But you have been a guest several times, and they've been great programs and give us great insights. I'm sure today will be no different. But before we get into exotic propulsion, a lot of listeners may not know what the Space Studies Institute is, so why don't you give us the introduction and 101 to it?
Surely. It's Space Studies Institute. You can find out more, of course, at ssi.org. It was founded in 1977, so actually next year will be our 40th anniversary. It was founded by Gerard K. O'Neill, a Princeton physics professor, who was promoting the idea of permanent human settlement of space. He published articles about space settlement, space colony, started in, I believe it was 1972 in Physics Today, and actually did engineering analyses of orbiting, rotating space settlements that would provide artificial gravity and typically be located at the L5 or L4 points of the Earth-Moon system. So O'Neill, as a pioneer in this area, decided that he needed a nonprofit to promote the concept. And this was also at the same time that the notion of satellite solar power and extraterrestrial resources were kind of at the forefront of what then was not even called new space, but basically was new space. So he established the organization and served as its head until he passed away from cancer in the early 1990s, at which point his friend Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton took over the presidency. But, of course, with Freeman's many other duties, SSI somewhat languished over the years. It wasn't able to continue its conferences and its activities until 2012, I believe it was, when he asked me to take over as president, which I was honored to do. And since that time, we've tried to bring back some of the legacy foci of the Institute, which includes, we're not an advocacy organization. We're focused on the hardware and the technology that's necessary to ultimately create permanent human settlements in space. And so we're interested in propulsion. We're interested in utilization of extraterrestrial resources and so forth. So SSI has always been aimed at doing hardware developments or technology developments versus simply going out and lobbying for more budget for NASA or whatever. So among the projects I started when I took over was the G-Lab, which we've talked about, I think, on a previous show, which is it tries to answer the question, what is the minimum G-level that is necessary for human health and reproduction, which is, of course, the critical issue for permanence in space. And then E-Lab, which is closed life support systems and technology. And then in a step farther out, if you want to call it that, I said we should also be looking at cutting-edge physics questions as it relates to propulsion, because, of course, propulsion is critical to going anywhere in the solar system or interstellar space. So we've started those three initiatives, and I think today you largely want to talk about EPI, our Exotic Propulsion Initiative, which has attracted a lot of attention.
Absolutely. Why the focus on exotic propulsion? Is it because it's actually plausible and near term, or is it just something you think is needed? Because, you know, many people think it's years, if not decades, away from reality.
Well, we have always taken a long-term view of the future, of course. The space settlement is going to take it is a long-term vision. It's not something that happens in the next 5 years or the next decade or potentially even the next few decades. So, but if you ask the question, what do you need for long-term, permanent human habitation of space? I think the answer is you have to get there. You have to be able to interact with settlements, whether they're planetary-based or free space settlements. And you ultimately have to do business with the center of economic power in the solar system, which is, of course, Earth. That's where all economy is currently focused, but that won't always be true. And so you need to be able to take people and cargo to and from terrestrial markets, I think, for space settlements to be feasible in the future. And, of course, we're bound by the tyranny of the rocket equation. I've been a rocket plumber all my life and focused on doing the best we can with chemical propulsion and maybe a few more advanced systems like nuclear or whatever. But I don't think anyone questions the statement that absent a really low-cost and efficient means of propulsion, we're going to be terrestrially bound for the foreseeable future. So advanced propulsion, propellantless propulsion, whatever you want to call it, is definitely needed to both get us off Earth and traveling through the cosmos. So it was first a vision that we need something like this without necessarily knowing how to accomplish it. And then secondly, it was, right at the edge of known physics, there are some interesting, potentially, well, at least at the near term, somewhat inexplicable phenomena that have been observed, which might be experimental error or might be real. We don't know. We're trying to answer that question. And if we don't do it, i.e. if SSI doesn't do it, who else will? That's the fundamental question. We're not afraid of being embarrassed by doing something stupid, because if you are, you will never do anything. You'll never accomplish anything. So we're out there sticking our necks out saying, is this feasible? And hoping for support from our listeners and our members and the public at large to try and answer this question definitively.
So NASA has EagleWorks, so they're doing it, I guess, on some level with exotic propulsion, right?
They are, and I actually have a little personal history with EagleWorks, because before it was EagleWorks at NASA, the two gentlemen who have been most connected with EagleWorks, Dr. Sonny White and Paul March, who was his colleague and technician at Johnson Space Center until recently. Both of them were actually funded by me personally in sort of the 2008 timeframe to set up a company called EagleWorks LLC, which actually predated the establishment of EagleWorks at Johnson Space Center. And I funded that to the tune of a few hundred thousand dollars to begin to answer some of these questions. But the economic super recession that we had at the time really limited my ability to do much. And consequently, Sonny ultimately ended up taking that EagleWorks brand and transferring it to NASA and setting up the lab there. So I've been pretty familiar with what's been going on there for the last 10 years or so.
Do you think some of these, let's do it this way. I've done a lot of programs with people from around the world who claim to be writing about or working on M-Drive. So let me just focus on M-Drive for a moment, from the UK to other people in this country to Kickstarter plans for M-Drive. And I know you just had this conference in Colorado, which seems to me like it's sort of resurrecting the old high-quality STAFE conferences. Is that something you have in mind with this exotic propulsion conference?
Yes, actually, we went to some trouble to call it a workshop as versus a conference, because first off, it was invitation only. We didn't want to kind of just open it up to everybody and their brother who had a Dean Drive concept to come in. We wanted, you know, professional physicists and engineers to kind of let their hair down and talk about the critical issues that have to be addressed to make the science credible to the community at large. In any case, the STAFE meetings were at the back of our minds setting it up. In fact, it was a STAFE meeting where I first met Jim Woodward. It's unfortunate that those have kind of gone away. But, you know, really what we were trying to do is bore down into the physics and the engineering and the analysis, the bench science work that has been going on for both M-Drive and Woodward Mach effect type concepts and so on, to just, you know, to understand what the theories might be, what the sources of experimental error are, all these things that, you know, have to be addressed.
Woodward has been on my show multiple times, and I've been to his lab for two space shuttle programs over 2 years, and I've taken a physicist with me to help space shuttle listeners understand what it is that Heidi and he are working on, and I know he was headed off as soon as I left his offices that day this year at Space 2016. He was leaving for Colorado for the workshop. Where in your opinion, when Woodward presents and talks about the Mach thruster effect, where does it sort of stand within the community? The question is it real or an experimental artifact that they're seeing? And if it's real, can it be scaled up? And, you know, does it have the potential that Heidi and he seem to think it does?
Sure. Well, let me first preface comments by saying I'm a simple-minded rocket plumber. I'm not a physicist, so I understand pointy end forward, hot stuff out the back, and that's about my limits. But I've known Jim for a decade or more now, and have visited his lab many times and seen the device in test or devices in test. So let me back up by telling you an anecdote. I guess old people, you know, have to
tell stories. Right?
Tell stories, right? So I'm going to tell a story. So this whole area has been a personal interest of mine for some time, and I'll tell you how far back that goes. It goes back to 1960 when I was 10 years old and read Arthur Clarke's Profiles of the Future for the first time. There's a chapter in that book which is titled Space the Unconquerable. The last paragraph in that chapter says, "No man will ever turn homeward from beyond Vega to greet those he knew and loved on Earth." And that, of course, is because Vega is 26 light years away, and that's basically a whole human lifetime, even at the speed of light, you know, to go there and to come back in Earth time, the Earth brain. So when you're 10 years old, you don't want to be told you can't do something, right? So a dozen years later, I was sitting with Arthur Clarke at his club, the Arts Club in London. It was only going to be a very brief meeting because I was in London for some other reason. And he was supposed to have dinner with Patrick Moore, the noted British astronomer, that night. But Moore had a cold. And so Arthur basically spent the evening with me talking about space stuff. So I remember that conversation pretty distinctly, and the one thing I did say to him is I wanted to prove him wrong on that comment he made in Profiles of the Future. And instead of, you know, just patting me on the head as a wet behind the ears 22-year-old kid, I'm rather eternally grateful to him that he said to me, you know, you may have a chance, and he actually encouraged me to look at questions beyond sort of accepted physics. And of course, he was a physicist, so he knew a little bit about what he was talking. Then he told me something which I've never forgotten and has burned into my mind, and it's also written in some of those articles and commentaries, and that is that to be successful in the quest for a space drive, which is what he called it, you need to find a physicist who will give you a straight answer to the question, what is inertia? By the way, I told this story at the opening of the workshop, and I got raucous laughter from all the physicists in the room because they know what I'm talking about. So the bottom line is that the only physicist that I have so far encountered who has given me a straight answer to the question, what is inertia, was Jim Woodward, when I asked him around 2005. And that caused me to pay attention to him. I mean, his background is rather exotic. He has a physics degree, but he also has a history of physics, PhD, which makes him an expert on Einsteinian general relativity, among other topics. And he spent a lot of time thinking about those very early days with Einstein, Mach, and the rest of the notable physicists of the 20th century. So he began to understand what inertia may well be and incorporated it both into a theory, which is important, and provided some experimental evidence to support his position. And when he was just Jim Woodward talking about it, I would listen respectfully. But not being a physicist, I can't answer. I mean, I can't delve into the math and the details of the system as much as I would like to. But then Professor Heidi Fern at Cal State Fullerton joined him, and, she trained under Peter Maloney. She's a quantum physicist. She, is published and so forth, as is Jim. And she looked at it and said, there may be a pony in here. And when you get two, distinguished physicists saying that there might be something here, I begin to pay more attention from an engineering perspective. So, for years, Jim has done his work in almost a garage style lab. You've been there. You know that pretty much paid for this all out of his own pocket and so forth.
Yeah, made most of the equipment himself. And,
yes.
There's no room to even breathe in his lab.
Right. And it is, he's funded it himself. He's an experimentalist. He's built the hardware. He's chased down experimental errors. And then Heidi has started, and then he built a theory around it as well, which I think is a pretty solid theory. And then Heidi refined that theory and is building on it because she's really a theorist, not an experimentalist. But it's very amusing and gratifying to see her soldering circuit boards in the lab and moving into the experimentalist realm as well, because you want to have that cross-disciplinary talk and activity to make something, as unusual as this work. Anyway, so Jim gave me a straight answer to what inertia is, which is the response of local matter being accelerated and communicating with all the rest of the matter in the universe, what Mach called the distant stars, because Mach, of course, didn't even know that, we had more than a galaxy of stars, right? So, because he was theorizing at the late 19th century and the early 20th. So, one thing I did ask Jim there are two issues here. One is, are we looking at experimental error? And they've chased down vibrations, they've chased down Lorentz forces, they've chased down all sorts of things that could be going wrong within the device. And what's interesting about the way they do their tests is that they run a test and then they flip the test article, the Mach effect thruster, 180 degrees, and run the test. So if there is a experimental error that is being created by the way the balance works, the balance is it's a knife edge balance. The electrical power goes through liquid metal contact so that there's no transfer of forces on it. You know, they've done a lot of stuff. They have a Faraday cage around the device itself. So they chased this all down, and when they reversed the thrust of the device, the apparent thrust reversed. Now, the problem, of course, is these thrusts are very, very tiny. But the theory suggests, and I'm only talking now, of course, about Mach effect devices versus M-drives, which is a separate topic. The theory suggests that the thrust will scale as something like the fourth power of, I believe it's the input voltage. The problem, of course, is that you bump the power up. These devices are very small. They're about an inch in diameter, made of piezoelectric and electrostrictive material. PZT, I believe, is the material. Anyway, this is the same thing that is used in sonar devices and so on. So if you dump more and more power into it, the devices heat up, and they heat up above what's called the Curie point, and they depolarize. They basically lose their properties. So the thrust goes away if you do that. Jim refers to it as smoking the device, basically, you know, cooking it so that it's too hot to function. So a really functional device, so he does like single pulses of thrust. And the thrust is micro-newtons. It's like a fly's wing beating. It's really amazingly small. In space, of course, it would have value, but it doesn't do us any good for getting off the planet. So the question is, how much can you pump up the power without smoking a device? And they've been doing that. They've been increasing power. They see thrust increasing with power, but we're a long way from being able to, say, have the device push on my hand, which is what I would really like it to do. Nevertheless, you know, some physicists who have looked at it concur that there's something interesting here. There's certainly going to be a group of physicists who haven't ever looked at it and reject it out of hand for conservation momentum reasons or so forth. And, you know, I can't say anything to those guys except come look, you know, do the math, see what happens. This is not crackpot stuff. This may be wrong, but it is by no means crackpot.
There's a lot of interest in it, and, you know, it would be nice if he were better funded, obviously, so he could do more and get more power into his experiments. When he presents, do his peers take it seriously? Or, well, I guess anyone at this workshop, they would be acceptable of the possibility of exotic propulsion, so that's probably not the right question to ask. You know, if he was presenting at an AIAA propulsion meeting, maybe the reaction might be different.
Well, he has presented at such venues in the past, and of course, you know, you can never really tell. I mean, it's not like peer review to present at a conference. You know, I've presented at conferences, and I'm sure there were plenty of people in the audience who disagreed with whatever I was saying. But he has published peer review articles on the theory and on the test. Both he and Heidi have published articles or presented articles at the joint propulsion conference that the AIAA runs and so on. Certainly nobody in the audience has said that it's an intentional fraud. Sort of dismissed that.
Oh, and if you met Woodward, he's not capable of fraud. He's one of the most ethical guys I've ever met.
Yeah, it's simply impossible to imagine. But then the question is, you know, are they deluded looking at the data or whatever? And all I can say is that of the people attending, I mean, we had people like Martin Tamar, who's been from Dresden, you know, who's been involved in the advanced propulsion community for some years. And he, you know, has tested M drives and so forth. You know, he was there. He was not critical. He was definitely open-minded. He traveled all the way from Germany to attend. We had Nembo Boldrini, who traveled from Austria. We had George Hathaway, who traveled from Toronto, Canada. who's tested many, sort of weird physics, weird engineering concepts for potential investors and so forth. So we're, you know, there's something going on here at the fringes of physics. And what interests me is not just what Jim's doing, which I think is credible, honest, experimental research, which may or may not work, I don't know. But I'm reasonably convinced that there's a pony in that corral. I don't know what its color is. I don't know how many ponies are in it. All I know is that I've seen something that I can't explain except by Jim's Mach effects explanation. But then there's the M drive, which is seemingly orthogonal to everything that Jim is doing. So, it uses microwaves, it uses a copper frustum or cavity. It's like, what the heck is going on with that? And that was a major subject of conversation, people, presenting results on their tests and so forth. And what I can say about it is that there also seems to be something there. Now, I think there was pretty much universal concurrence with the notion that Scheuer, the originator of the M drive in the United Kingdom, that his explanation of the theory that he has of how the M drive works is probably wrong. There wasn't a lot of support. Again, this is just me, a non-physicist, as a rapporteur reporting on what I heard sitting in the audience. I don't think there was very much support for Scheuer's theories. But if the experiments are, if the data is good, there's something going on. And then the question turned to, can Woodward Fearn's Mach effect theory explain the Scheuer results? And the answer is possibly. And this gets into an area where I cannot defend. If your readers call in and say, explain that, the answer is no way am I going to be able to explain it. But what I heard from the professional physicists in the room is that there's possibly a connection, and it basically involves the use of dielectric material within the Scheuer device and the fact that dielectrics exist in the Mach effect device, and that what Scheuer might in fact be seeing is a Mach effect activity at higher power. So, again, this gets me into areas where I can't do anything except observe as an interested observer, not a participant. But I think that this is right at the edge of being interesting, and it deserves the amount of attention that SSI is giving it and the amount of funding that SSI is giving it, which is, a few thousand dollars here and there. I mean, it's not like we're spending millions of dollars on this. But thanks to donations that we've received from around the world, we've basically turned those around. We don't, we have very small administrative costs. We don't take, salaries or anything like that. We turn it around and we give it to researchers like Woodward to actually extend their experimental work as well as their theories.
Was Paul March was at this workshop talking about M-Drive, is that correct?
That is correct.
And what was he able to say what they have found out about it at Eagle Works? Was he able to talk freely?
He was able to talk freely, but we also, being a private invited-only conference, we got him on the condition that we not publicize his results until the paper that has been accepted into the Journal of Propulsion and Power of the IAA that he and Sonny White and others have written gets published in December. So I'm basically under embargo to talk about Paul's comments or anything in Sonny's paper. I've not seen the paper myself, so that's easy for me to not talk about. I did hear Paul's comments, but I will say, and this will be a personal, not an SSI comment, and it has nothing, you know, this does not extend any information that Paul supplied at the meeting, but from other well-informed sources, I have been told that positive thrust was seen on the part of the experiments conducted at NASA. I have no reason to doubt the source of that information, but at the same time, that's rumor. You know, it may be well-sourced rumor, but it's rumor.
I did a show not too long ago with a person in England studying M-drive, and I forget his name. It was about 3 months ago, and he talked about their paper that was pending, and he said rumor was that there were positive results, and if that turned out to be the case, there might be some funding going into projects around the world that could help move it along. So,
well, there are, yes, David, I think that's correct. Now, whether that funding, say, comes from NASA or DARPA or Air Force or, you know, wherever, I don't know. But I do know that people are paying attention to this. I mean, I've been asked at one point to provide some technical due diligence, rather amusingly, since I'm not a physicist, related to a company that has proposed an M-Drive for satellite propulsion and reaction control. And I had a decline on the grounds that I wasn't qualified to provide a reasonable evaluation. But I know that there are companies out there. There's one, I'm trying to remember the name of it, somewhere back east, Kana, which has a drive concept that's similar to M-Drive, but I think it's cryogenic because this increases the efficiency of the drive, at least according to the developer, whose name, Guido Fetta, is the fellow's name. And I know that that was tested at Eagle Works. They talked about that fairly publicly a year or two ago. And the results, I think, were somewhat equivocal, but I don't want to disparage the Kana drive or the results that they may have had, but I know that that company is continuing with its efforts. I think they announced a CubeSat mission or something that they want to fly next year. I don't know whether that will happen or not, but they certainly seem to have some money to. I think they have more money than SSI to support.
Is SSI going to run this workshop next year?
We are certainly thinking about it. You know, whether it's every year or every 2 years or whatever, I think that'll largely depend on the technical committee and the participants, you know, commentary. I was gratified at the end of the workshop to have pretty much everybody, I will say everybody because I got no negative comments at all, come up to me and say, this was a great thing for you to do, you know, to sponsor and to have here, and we need to do it again and make it a routine sort of thing. And so I'm certainly persuaded to have it again next year, but it's also a lot of work to organize it, even as small as it was. You know, there were, you know, 25, 30 people. But it's not trivial to organize it, and especially over a three-day activity as remote as Estes Park is. But yeah, I think we'll probably do it again.
And you don't have press coming there, do you?
No, because we want people to be able, I mean, this is kind of, is more of an academic versus an engineering-oriented activity, so we kind of use the same academic rules that that happen. And, you know, if you go into a conference at a university or a meeting at a university where people are talking about unpublished results and so on, there's no legal bar against press. The general ethical approach is that, you know, unpublished results are not reported until peer-reviewed papers come out and so on. Now, we have gotten approval from all the attendees to post their presentations, their audio, and their video, and we're busily editing the audio and video for sound quality and camera angles and so on. I mean, we had a crew there filming, but we don't just want to put raw video up. We'd actually like to, you know, condense it and turn it into something that's useful for scholars and researchers.
When do you think that'll get posted? I'm dying to ask.
We all are. I've not seen but one or two myself. The plan is to have everybody submit sort of their final text and presentation material that they want in hardbound proceedings by December 1st, and then the organizers will spend probably 30 days or so editing. Hopefully it will go that fast. Of course, everybody's doing this in volunteer time.
So you're talking early next year, probably.
Yeah, so I think the videos will probably go up in December. That's my hope. That was our plan. The proceedings probably won't actually get printed and be available for sale on Amazon until I want to say maybe February, March, something like that.
Okay.
But we'll certainly we're committed to making this as open as possible. The other thing is we can't show Paul March's presentation until that Journal of Propulsion and Power paper comes out, which is scheduled for December. So we're embargoed on that.
I've got a caller on hold that I'm going to bring up. Plus, I have an email question for you regarding what SpaceX is doing. But let's take the caller first. Hi,
sure.
Caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John Fort Worth.
Okay. I've got people waiting, John, so you're going to have to be succinct today since we have a deadline coming up on the end of the show.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make the comment that I was wondering on the scalability of the Woodward effect. I guess one thing about it is I'm wondering, is the idea to build a bigger Woodward device, or is it more like to make a whole bank of small ones, like a big array, matrix array of them?
Excellent question. I think the consensus of the discussion was the latter rather than the former. So people were talking about, you know, can you make it down almost to the semiconductor scale, you know, where you'd make lots of these on a chip, you know, sort of like a MEMS device or a group of MEMS devices locked in synchrony, you know, thrusting together. And so I think the short answer is it's probably clusters and arrays rather than, you know, one giant warp drive machine in the back of the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I was kind of wondering, because that would mean that even if you have, you know, 10 micro newtons of thrust, if you have enough of these devices, or, you know, if you get up to maybe 100 micro newtons and then you have a whole bunch of these, you could have a reasonable thrust for like an orbit-to-orbit type vehicle.
Exactly. And, of course, you know, the other two things we want to see is we want to see cooling, because that will allow us to stay below the Curie point, at least for Woodward devices. And we want to see increased power, which, of course, is coupled to the cooling. So these questions, I mean, we weren't doing engineering at this workshop. We were doing most of physics, but there were lots of people who were going away, you know, driving home and flying home, thinking about how do we scale this thrust to unambiguously large thrust. Because that silences critics of the approach, whether it's M-Driver or Woodward.
Yeah. And one final thing, I guess you're short on time here, I understand, so I'll just bring up the idea that I actually brought up with Dr. Woodward is, that on the one hand, he's focused completely on the propulsion device, but this is also a very interesting physics experiment he's doing. And I think that in itself is another line that some people ought to focus on this effect, because I think that if the physics community accepted it as an advance in knowledge of physical law, then the engineering community and the you know, industrial community would be much more accepting of these results.
Indeed, Indeed, and that's a great point. I would say in the last year, I had a conversation with an industrial physicist from a major aerospace company on exactly this point. He was interested more from the pure physics question than as a propulsion device. And I completely agree, if we could engage some research physicists on that point, it would be great. By the way, if you want to continue this conversation, my email at SSI is just gary@ssi.org. Happy to talk further by email.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll clear the line then, I guess, and let you get on to the other question you have.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Possibly, because these are really fascinating discussions, if John goes through the Space Show blog and I send you the links, you can email him through the blog, and then the listeners can benefit from your combined wisdom and questions.
Yep. Happy to do that.
So this is a question from Joe in Denver, and we've got another caller on hold, but let me do Joe's question. He says, it seems to me that Mr. Musk with SpaceX that has basically a clean slate for what he is building should be pursuing something like this for his grand plans for Mars rather than conventional rockets. I know conventional rockets can get him to and from Mars. That's not the issue. But this is a guy with money and a clean slate of infrastructure and hardware, nothing legacy other than maybe the Falcon 9. But why wouldn't he pursue technology and propulsion, possibly using Mach thrusters or maybe M-drive, even to a small amount of his propulsion R&D?
Well, I certainly don't. I'm not inside Elon's head, so I couldn't tell you. But I do know two things. One is he's very single-mindedly focused on Mars. In the most friendly terms possible, I would say he has a fanatical focus on Mars.
He's OCD. That would be another way of saying it.
Yes. but the second thing is, I do know that there has been interest on the part of individuals who work at SpaceX, either personally and privately or in connection with their job, to explore this area. However, they have taken on so much on their plate that Elon wants to do things himself, you know, how he takes projects in-house and so on. So I don't think that he has something to bring to this. He's a potential customer for this type of technology, and he is a potential source of financing for this type of technology. I think if he was willing to come to SSI and say, you know, I'll give you $100,000 a year to go out and try and make this work, we'd be delighted. If he just wants to do it himself, I guess we'd be delighted too, because we want it to happen. We're not in it to make money. But I want to make sure that I'd like to see him focus on what he needs to focus on and leave some of the scraps from that big plate full of food for the rest of us in the industry. We want to have more than a monoculture going forward in the space business.
Let's see who your other caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is John from Fremont, California.
Okay.
Gary, longtime SSI senior associate, and really appreciate everything that you guys are doing. Exotic propulsion initiative that SSI's got going it looks like it's focused only on Woodward's research. Are you do you have any plans for supporting some of the other exotic propulsion technologies that were covered at the conference?
Yes. So you're absolutely correct. First of all, thanks very much for being a longtime senior associate. We can't do this without people like yourself. Second, we started with Woodward for two reasons. One, I thought he had a fairly convincing argument, both theoretical and experimental, for the effect. But secondly, because frankly he was the cheapest project we could do, I had spent several hundred thousand dollars kicking off EagleWorks LLC, but I just didn't have those resources any longer to donate to SSI. Jim does his thing with, you know, $10,000 a year. So, you know, scrounging stuff and what have you. So, he was the very first project I could support. But the whole idea of the workshop was to open it up so that we could start identifying other research, whether it be theoretical analysis that needs to be done, you know, building theories, proving them out, or seeing actual experimenters come in. And, you know, people like George Hathaway and Martin Tamar and Nembo Boldrini, who have access to precision balances, to, you know, thrust balances to measure effects and so on. We will absolutely support these people when the dollars are there to do it. So the workshop was one step towards that goal. The next step has to be, you know, 1 to 1,000 people writing checks of a few thousand dollars each to start making this happen. I mean, our ultimate goal is to test one or more of these devices in, you know, like a 12U CubeSat or a 3U CubeSat or something, which would be a pretty unambiguous test if you put it in Earth orbit and it spirals out to, you know, a lunar L2 point or something like that, you know, and has no other propulsion on it. That would, you know, answer the mail as far as I'm concerned. But that's a, you know, a couple million dollars worth of effort. So it all comes down to money.
Yeah, okay. Hey, thanks very much, Gary.
My pleasure.
Thanks, John, and talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
So, listeners, there's a little bit of time left, and if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. And I have another question, and it's actually from Larry in Tucson, but it's what we talked about before the show started. And he wondered if you would share your thoughts on the progress and the direction of commercial space and the Musk plan to go to Mars. So that doesn't give you a lot of time to do it. But Larry in Tucson is, giving us a divergent topic as we end the show.
Well, it's both divergent and convergent. I mean, it's convergent to the extent that, you know, going to Mars or anywhere in the solar system with the goal of permanent settlement is certainly within SSI's wheelhouse. I mean, that's absolutely the case. But specifically talking about Elon's notion is, what are they calling it now, the Interplanetary Transport Ship,
right?
ITS. I always thought he hated acronyms, so I'm not sure why he went to an acronym. Anyway,
well, he had a naming contest for that, remember? And that was the name they chose.
Oh.
Yeah, that was a contest among his followers, and that's the name that was chosen.
I see. Well, so briefly, I, with all, you know, reasonable respect to what he has accomplished today, I think it's kind of insane. And the reason I think it's insane is not the ambition that, to my mind, is fine. I'm bothered by two things. One is the scale of the vehicle, not the scale of the mission, you know, sending a million people to Mars or whatever, but the scale of the vehicle. This is 4 times the size of a Saturn V. It's well above the experience base we have for liquid rockets. And the, you know, just things like the acoustic signature of a vehicle with that amount of thrust. I mean, we're talking, what, 30 million pounds of thrust or something on that scale. That's even bigger than anybody has proposed in the NOVA days, with the occasional exception of, like, Truax and Seadrag. So I think it's a completely unrealistic plan in terms of the scale of the ITS itself, or ICT, or whatever it's called. So that's an engineering comment. I have a overarching comment, which is, I think Mars is the wrong destination. I mean, the reason I'm involved with SSI is that O'Neill long ago said that is the bottom of a gravity well the right place for an expanding technological civilization, you know, for the millennia to come. And I think the answer is no. I think if you're going to go into space, you don't go to the bottom of a gravity well like Mars, which has all sorts of challenges. You don't go to the bottom of a gravity well like the moon. You may go to Mars for tourism and science. You may go to the moon for resources because it's close to Earth. But what you're going to do is you're going to build 1G settlements in space. I mean, on Mars, we can shield against radiation by burrowing underground. We can grow food. We can generate power by, you know, using nuclear power or whatever. We can't change the gravity. The gravity is, you know, 0.4 G. You're stuck with that. And what if you can't live at 0.4 G? This is, of course, the whole point of our G-Lab experiment to understand that. Elon seems completely oblivious to that. He's sort of just, you know, waving his hand and saying, I'm not going to think about it. I don't want to think about it. Whereas if you have rotating settlements, you can make them 1G. And now you control the entire environment, control radiation, control G levels. You control everything. So I think the future of human settlement in space is in free space settlement, as O'Neill predicted and projected, not as planetary settlements.
I don't think you'll persuade Elon otherwise.
I won't. I know that.
So even if exotic propulsion were available, that would not alter your opinion about Mars as a settlement destination?
Not at all. Propulsion is just a tool. In the end, you have to look at the entire architecture, the strategy of what you're trying to accomplish. If you're trying to make humanity resilient and give it an unlimited frontier, you don't do it by going back into the caves. And planetary surfaces are the caves of the Neanderthals. It's not the future, as far as I'm concerned, or SSI is concerned, you know, going forward.
So the other ideas that are out there are the moons of Mars, because they're easier. Lockheed has an idea called Mars Base Camp, which I'm sure the planetary protection folks are orgasmic about, because there you're orbiting Mars, and the only things that get down to the surface are robots controlled by the crew on the orbiting platform. Where does that fit in terms of settlement ideas, or is that more R&D, you know, maybe tourism, but certainly scientific research?
Well, I think the moons of Mars are perfectly good candidates for future settlements. I'm not sure you want to go to that distance, because, I mean, if you're going to sell, I mean, if there's going to be economic intercourse with Earth, the center of the economic and human solar system, you really want to be close. And that's, I think, why O'Neill suggested, like, the L5 point of the Earth-Moon system. If you go to Phobos, you have resources, i.e. you have Phobos and you have Deimos, but Phobos is probably the best one. So, but you could also go to any asteroid and get the same thing. So I think you only go to Phobos if you are interested in doing something with Mars, whether it be teletourism, whether it be real tourism, whether it be telescience, whether it be real science on the surface, whatever. And I, you know, when I proposed a Mars mission, an exploratory Mars mission back in 1988 in an AIAA paper, which people can find online, that I proposed using single-staged orbit vehicles, carrying propellant, refueling, pre-positioning propellant at Phobos. And Phobos is actually the destination. And once you have pre-positioned propellant there, then you can sortie down to the surface for like 5-day missions or 10-day missions to explore interesting things on the surface, rather than, you know, haul everything down to the surface of Mars and to then have to haul stuff up from it.
Gary, we have consumed an hour, so
there you are.
Time goes really fast. When you have the audio and the papers up and available, if you can remember to let me know, I'll certainly tell listeners about it and promote them both on Amazon or wherever on the Space Show, as this audience is very interested in what you're doing and in exotic propulsion. So please keep me posted with like that. And it's been great talking to you again, and keep up the good work. And you always have an audience here for these things, because we're very supportive of this and what you're doing. So
when the proceedings come out, let's do this again.
Absolutely. So just I'll try to follow it. I guess you'll be able to see it on the website, right?
Yes. Yeah, and I'll make sure to ping you when it comes out.
Okay. Then I'll talk to you again probably before the end of the year, and I look forward to it. And thank you again for this great work, and we appreciate your being back on the Space Show.
My pleasure, David. Thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today, and come back on Sunday. And everybody have a great weekend that is coming up. Goodbye from Gary and the Space Show and myself.